Good evening, everybody. Hey, I'm Jason Slingerland from the Building the Game podcast. You are here for another episode of Something from Nothing, the show where we get together and we talk as game designers about different designs we're working on and also problems we're having and mechanics and all that good fun stuff. We've got a good panel of people tonight. Myself, who's always here, as I said, is Jason Slingerland from the Building the Game podcast. We also have, as usual, Chevy Dodd, known best for ChevyDodd.com. And also the game Scallywags, and a bunch of other stuff, like Paper Route and sweet stuff. Then we have TC Petty, also a regular panelist here, known for many caffeinated games, such as Viva Java and also Viva Java Dice. Soon, Viva Java, the movie, I'm sorry to spoil it here, but live-action movie, it's going to happen. It's going to be pretty sweet. We also have a couple guest panelists I'm really excited about. I'm going to let them introduce themselves. We'll start with Mr. J. Alex Kevern. Hopefully I'm pronouncing your last name right.
Yes, you're right. So, my name's Alex. I am one third of Project Game, which is a game design group from Chicago. I have two games coming out in 2014. One is Gold West from Project Game, and the other is a game called Daxa, which is a two-player strategy game that recently got picked up by White Goblin Games in Europe. So, that's me, and I'm sure talk a little more about what I've been working on later in the show, but that's me.
Cool. And then we've also got joining us Mr. David Short. Hey, David, go ahead and introduce yourself.
Hi, I'm obviously David, and I've got two published games out right now. Both of them are from TMG, Ground Floor and Skyline. And then I've got another game coming out signed with AEG for 2014. And, of course, I've got many other buns in the fire. So.
Oh, so cool. That's new. I mean, does that mean that you actually have that the other project you're working on is actually published now or will be published? Or is that secret?
Wait, which one?
The one for AEG.
So AEG's already signed, and we're finishing up development on it.
Okay.
Nice.
Which one is that?
It's Microgame. I developed it with the name Enquêteur, which is French for investigator. But it's not
part of the Tempest line?
It is in the Tempest line. Okay. Yep. I designed it specifically to be a sequel to Love Letter. It's the first game that I ever designed with a publisher and with a, I guess, such a narrow focus. I knew exactly what I wanted to be micro game, wanted to be in the Tempest line, I wanted to be for AEG specifically, and so that was a lot of restrictions, and it was a nice kind of thing to be able to see what you could do within such a tight, such tight parameters. And I kind of all put my eggs in one basket because if AEG passed it up, I wasn't sure what I was going to do with it.
So that, does that mean it's 17 cards?
It's 19.
Oh, wow.
19 cards. So that's all. Other than being a micro, it doesn't really have anything else in common with Love Letter. So they're going to be changing the name, and they're going to be changing which characters each card is, because they want it to be. I had a lot of overlap between my characters and Love Letter characters, so they're changing that up to have almost no overlap is what they're trying to do.
That's cool. Yeah.
Hey, just for the listeners out there, if you're interested. And asking us questions, we'll answer them on the air here, as many as we can. You can tweet us. The easiest way to get hold of us is to tweet us with the hashtag BTGSFN. And we'll answer those. Anybody got anything that they're working on right now they want to talk about? Specifically?
TC. I see.
TC does. All right.
I always see some interesting things. New news with me is that I put up a print and play, which seems to be the thing. If I'm working on a smaller game, that's the thing to do, I feel. And I saw that David has the Bomb Squad game up on BGG with a print and play. So I was kind of curious, how do you guys feel about print and plays? I guess my issue is, do you feel it's worth it? I kind of go in the idea that maybe 5 people will download it, and if that happens, that's great. If like 2 people read the rules, that's fine. But it only really like gets people only download it if you go, oh wait, it's also being published. Then they're suddenly like, oh crap, I gotta download this thing. But so how do you guys feel about releasing print and plays? Do you think it's helpful from a design standpoint, or do you think it's just kind of superfluous, I guess?
I can take a stab at that. So I haven't had much success getting feedback when you just throw it out there. Mostly we found it to be a kind of just early kind of groundwork for buzz and get people talking about it. But as far as it being this tool for, you know, easy blind testing, it doesn't work out. At least that's what's been my experience. You actually have to seek out specific blind playtesters who are going to put in the work, and you send them the prototype. And, you know, they might use the PMT files that you have up there, but they've specifically contacted you. You talk over what parameters you want them to work within and things like that. But Joe Schmo just downloading it without me knowing about it and then him randomly contacting me with feedback, I haven't seen happen.
Yeah, I think a lot of it depends on where the game is at in your eyes. And because a lot of times I find that the feedback I sort of get from anonymous players. So my game Daxa, which was called Crosstown, was actually up as a print and play and actually got some great feedback from people who had printed out and played it and wrote up session reviews on BGG. But I think that if you don't have a good grasp of what your sort of anchor is for the game, when you have so many different people playing it and giving feedback, it's easy to get away to sort of what your original design goals were for that game. So I think having an anchor in terms of what the game means to you and what you want the game to be will keep you from sort of getting distracted and derailed from sort of an influx of feedback from people who have sort of experienced the game independently away from sort of your presence, if that makes any sense.
Yeah,
that, like my personal experience is very similar to Alex's. Scallywag started as a print and play on BGG. It all began because I saw Zombie in My Pocket and thought, man, people were, like, hundreds of people were playing this, and that's all I've ever wanted. I don't really care about money, so I made Scallywag as a print and play, which is actually, like, not a very easy game to make because it requires you to custom make 40 coins, and they all have to have the identical backs. But people were like, well, you can just take a Sharpie to some pennies. Oh, well, that works. And so I put it on BGG as a print and play, and I probably had about, like, I don't know, 20 people played it in the course of a couple of months, and those are the people who really encouraged me to seek out publication for the game and ultimately led to it being published. So print and play has always had this, like, special little, you know, it's something I value a lot. But I try not to put early-stage prototypes out there. I do. Don't get me wrong. You can go look at every single terrible rendition of Dead End that's on my website. I've left them all out there for you. But that was a special project on its own. I would much prefer to put something that I consider to be, you know, 95% done in my eyes so that when I do get feedback, just like Alex said, you know this is either feedback that I want or I'm just going to ignore that because it's not the direction that the game went, you know. So, like, I just put up, I put up this little silly card game I made a couple weeks ago. Just
the skeet shooter.
Yeah, the skeet shooting game. You know, like, I designed it in an hour, and the print and play was available within 3 days. And, like, here you go, it's done. Have fun with it, you know. And I've already had probably about 7 or 8 people play it and respond to it. So, and that was just something, that was within the first, like, probably week I had 7 or 8 people playing it. So to me, it's a very valuable tool, but it's not something that you just put on BGG and it just magically happens. It takes a lot of work, you know. When I did Doubloons, I was very active in the print and play community on BGG. I was very active in the chat room on BGG, which people don't know exists. There is a print and play Secret Santa that I participated in for years, and my game would get made every single year by other people and sent to people. So I mean, it was a very big part of the success of Scallywags. So
yeah, I think that's important. I mean, but what you guys are saying, just managing your expectations. Like I said, sure. the fact that I'm like happy. I guess basically it's weird. Like it depends on the time of day. Sometimes when you post the file for the first time, but like it's just weird. Eventually, someone will do it, and I think that's just the point of it, really. I mean, you don't want to put all your hopes into it as if it's like the blind pay test thing. And I think what you guys are saying is mainly it's difficult when the print and play file is really complex. I would love to put up a print and play file of like a larger Euro game, but at the same time, I feel like that's kind of like a disservice to me. It's more of a deadline to finish what I was doing than it is anything else. So
yeah, it's much harder to do.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah, so that's cool. Yeah, and I just use print and play as a deadline too, so that helps too. But yeah, thanks.
They're interesting points you guys make about the volume of playtesters, because
sort of putting together. Am I being lost here? Somebody take over.
Just a little delay. All right.
Anyways, all right. Talking.
I was just. Oh.
Am I back? Okay, I think I'm back. So, what do you think about putting together a sort of a number of prototypes, a handful of prototypes, and then sending them out to people that you know across the country and having them play it and give you feedback on it? Has anyone sort of had that experience where you do all the work of sort of putting the prototypes together, so unlike a print and play, they don't have to do the work, but you just send it to them and then they can play it and give you feedback? Does anyone have any experience doing that?
Well, Grant,
I think you have.
I was going to say, Grant Rodiak did that for a while with his print and play pen pal thing or whatever.
Recently.
I think we're losing himself.
Yeah. I think that got the axe
delay there
recently because of
it. It did. You're right. It got axed because there was he had said there was a good deal of people playing. I thought, but I'm not. I don't remember exactly why he cut it. But yeah, that was
it kind of died out. But the fact is, if you put forth the effort to make the game and send it out, you have a much higher chance of somebody actually playing it. And a lot of times, now that I've done. I've probably had like 6 or 7 games that are print and play ready, and I have people printing and playing them. You can tell when somebody's played the game or when somebody's just read the rules and has responded, you know, to the rules without actually playing the game. And so you got to kind of be cautious of that also.
Well, though, Chevy, we put up some prototypes for the show, and I put up one of my game Potent Potions, and some of the best feedback I got was from Neil Roberts, who didn't play the game. He just read the rules.
Well,
and then
neat.
Did a bunch of magic math on it and told me like amazing feedback about the game without ever playing it.
That's so, Neil.
I know. Neil's
everybody able. Everybody should just send Neil the rules and he'll fix your game and then tell you that, you know, it's mathematically perfect. he's like a wizard. I don't know what he does. It's just Neil. But no, so feedback I think if you could put it together and send it, you're going to have a better chance of them playing it. And I do that quite a bit, actually. Most of my games I make at some point through the Game Crafter anyway. Whether I sell them on there or not, it's different. But I can easily just go order a copy, put your address in, and it's shipped to you. And I don't have to put forth the effort to do anything except pay a little bit of money to get you to play my game. And so that's an option also. They'll do drop shipping.
That's cool. Hey, TC.
Yeah.
We've got a few questions, and they're all for you. Flying Sheep has some questions about how do you pronounce your game? Is just Xenon? Xenon.
It's Xenon Profiteer.
Xenon Profiteer.
As boring as possible.
Okay. Ah. Okay. Anyways, he's interested in trying that. Second of all, he wants to know what percent done you think it is.
Definitely not Race for the Galaxy expansion.
Yeah, look how I crossed off the name here just to make sure that no one would be confused.
Sure.
The game itself, it's one of those weird things, like the game itself, it's black and white. I might actually, I like the aesthetic of that, because it's a very simple minimalist style game that also happens to be kind of in that deck building style. But it's like, what would you say? It's over 95% complete. Like I think Chevy was saying, I didn't want to put it out before I knew that all the mechanics were in place, all was working, and that I think if you played it with the right rules, you would have a good, enjoyable time. It's just more along the lines of, well, I have this cool idea for a card maybe that you could add, or this card is broken, actually. That's really what I want to know. Is this stuff broken? And that's why I put it out. It's there, so it's, you know, you can kind of count on it being actually good. It's just you need to be, is it good enough is what I want to know.
Yeah. Right? Don't we all want to know that?
Right. Hey, I think we, hopefully Neil Roberts wants more business, because I saw Flash Forward Games just tweeted him, like, as soon as we mentioned that.
I saw that.
They said, hey, Potted Meat, I heard you're going to the rules. How would they mention Chevy? Well, good, this will look like Chevy's fault. All right.
Sorry, Neil. The other thing, I just
he's
just
also very busy, just to be clear, so I don't know how soon he gets the stuff.
The other thing I just thought about in regards to print and play is you have to be really cautious about changing your game after you've put files out. For some people, it's not so bad to just update some components or whatever, but if your game is constantly evolving, to constantly ask somebody to print out a new set and play, it's very difficult. So, like, when I did... when I started my zombie game, for instance, Dead End, I had probably a good, like, 15 people that were really enthusiastic about it in the beginning, and they would print out, like, every new version. And now that we're down to, like, you know, version 23, I'm lucky to get, like, 3 people even give it a shot. Or the same with, like, with Hedeby. I had a ton of people when I first put it up playing it, and it's slowly dwindled off over time as I was like, hey, guys, you know, I know I just put out new files yesterday, but I changed them all. So print out 150 more cards today and fix it. And you know, people don't want to do that. So it depends on what you're going for. If you're looking for playtesters, then you're going to have to do it. If you're just looking to get people to play your game, then wait until it's a later stage and then try it.
And I think that's the point of being a confident where you think it is, so that you don't have to put up a million different updates every time. I mean, I found like one or two typos within the rules already, but that's bound to happen, and you can update the rules pretty quickly with a sentence or two.
Right.
But exactly. And I think that's key.
So. And like, so Flying Sheep just said, you know, his printer likes the black and white stuff too. Keep that in mind also. Not everybody can afford to print, you know, 20 pages full color all the time. So like, if I'm doing a serious print and play, I like to pay attention to, is my card game that I want you to print grayscale compatible? Because a lot of times you think it is, but until you print it, you'll realize that a lot of colors look really similar in grayscale. So if, you know, that stuff's a problem, then you need to pay attention to that. And sometimes I'll make a separate set that's just black and white or just line art, so it saves a lot of ink.
That's what's nice about the GameIcons.net website, being able to use their stuff, because it's all made for black and white, you know. I did that with Potent Potions. I literally just took all of their symbols and made it fit my game, and yeah, it was pretty awesome because it's easy on people's printers, and it was easy on me to not have to do design this stuff myself for a print and play, because not everybody can be Chevy Dodd when it comes to that.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. Most people have real jobs.
I don't want to usurp all the time, but at the same time, we have two esteemed new designers, and we're on the bleeding edge this week with our design panel. So I want to ask them just one question, because I think here's what I feel. Maybe this is incorrect or not. I have trouble with breaking from the norm with games. Every game that I start, I want to really, really do something completely different. Mm-hmm. And I find that really games are mainly taking existing mechanics and then mixing them up in a pile. I feel, and this, I don't know, hopefully it's not offensive, but I feel that David's game Ground Floor is a very a traditional spin on worker placement with some new elements added and some, I guess, interesting kind of, you can wait and then see you there. It's the timing of where the workers are put on and play and taken off is different. So I see that worker placement history, and then with Alex's game Gold West, which I got to play, reminds me of like a Kramer Kiesling mix-up if Steffenfeld had designed it. So it's like it's taking a little bit of a modern twist on that the idea of almost tile place, almost a little bit of a random setup, but then you use that to your advantage as the game is going on. So, I mean, I like Kiesling games, but I think this helps adding a little bit of a modern twist because they tend to have runaway leader problems.
Sure. Yeah.
So,
was that the greatest designer compliment?
How do you manage trying to break from the norm versus just tweaking existing things and making them better? Which do you think is better? And I don't know. How do you feel about it?
I think a lot of it comes down to sort of finding your own, I guess, niche as a designer. So, like, we can all look at a Feld game and sort of, even if we didn't know it was Feld, we would play it and say, this feels like a game, or this feels like a Canadian, Matt Leacock, or things like that. People break into the business, we're sort of trying to hone our craft a little bit and figure out sort of what we're good at, sort of what's our design style and things like that. So for me, you know, the games I like are, you know, things like Kramer or Feld or Knizia or things like that. And for me, it's sort of trying to understand why I like those games and sort of how they sort of build the incentive structures and what sort of trade-offs are present and how can I that sort of incorporate those things into my own design style while sort of making it my own. So I think, of course, we're always going to be influenced by especially the games that we like and the way they sort of do things. But I think the fun in becoming a designer is figuring out a way to hone that and combine ideas in ways that are sort of unique and feel fresh and feel modern and feel a niche in the gaming world that that sort of hasn't previously been filled. So that's sort of the way I look at it is, sure, we all sort of stand on the shoulders of giants a little bit, but trying to infuse your own voice into the designs is sort of what you have to do. And that's what that means to each person. That might mean... that might mean different things. So, those are great compliments, and it's certainly something that I've striven for is giving, not necessarily taking the mechanics from those types of games that I love, but giving my games, have them evoke the same sort of emotions and game feel that those games evoke. And hopefully accomplishing that through unique-ish ways is the way I want to do it. So I don't know if that answers your question at all, but yeah. So maybe, what do you think, David? Or TC?
TC, were you gonna say something?
No. Go for it, David. I was just agreeing.
Yeah. I mean, obviously, it's hard to do anything completely new, and obviously every game we play and everything we do in life is going to influence our designs, and you know, you can't ignore anything you've played previously. It's you can't just take that out of your mind. So everything you play and every mechanism that you come across, all those things are going to add to your toolbox and what you can draw from. Obviously, no one wants to make a clone, and no one wants to just, you know, put a new skin on a game. And so I believe we're all trying to strive for something unique. Now, the level of uniqueness is you know, variable and subjective. I, of course, personally, I think Ground Floor is groundbreaking and that it's an actual thematic Euro. It does have a mechanism in there that no one else has done before, but it gets drowned out by the other mechanisms that's in the game, mainly that it's worker placement, and obviously that's been done a billion times. So for me, I don't tend to think about, you know, hey, I want this to be completely unique, or hey, I want to grab this mechanism and build on top of it. None of those things actually come into mind when I'm designing. When I'm designing, my main focus is the game fun, and are people going to have a good time playing it? That's all I'm focused on. You know, whether I draw from this sandbox of mechanisms and, you know, twist them, or whether I stumble upon my own awesomeness, that's just from game to game. Recently, one of my newest projects is actually using the Mancala mechanism on steroids. Obviously, everybody brings up Trajan with that.
Mancala mechanism.
What was that?
The Mancala mechanism seems like a...
It's a running theme for this panel.
Yeah, well, it's funny because the mechanism doesn't actually have a name. And if you look up the Board Game Geek page of Mancala, it says something like pick up deliver, when it's not really pick up deliver. So Mancala actually is its own mechanism. And it'd be interesting to actually see 2 years from now with Trajan and, you know, hopefully my game, if it puts it on the map as actually its own mechanism. What I'm getting at is that Trajan actually blatantly steals Mancala, doesn't change anything about it whatsoever, but it puts it in this bigger arena where it uses other things in addition to that and makes it this bigger game. I actually kept it this simple game, but I did change it and alter it. Someone who plays my new game will definitely, if they have experience with Mancala, will definitely recognize it. But it is altered compared to Trajan, which is a blatant ripoff completely. It's just exactly Mancala and Trajan. You know, I did set out to use Mancala. It just, when I was making the new game, I had a theme, and I knew what I wanted to do. And that mechanism lended itself to the theme very well. You know, maybe I could have spent more weeks or months trying to not use a previous mechanism with myself, but A, I might not have ever found that unique mechanism. B, even if I did, it might not have been as good. So that's, you know, that's where we're at as far as whether you go for something unique or whether you just use what's there.
And I think that makes sense, honestly. Just the idea that if you're going to use something, it had better work within the theme that you're using that mechanism in the game. And I think even last episode we probably talked about that a bit with the thematic versus how do you game design? Do you work within a theme or with other things? So yeah, well. Like I said, I don't want to take up all the time, but I thought it would be interesting because, well, now I know that both game designers here are working on a Mancala game.
Yes.
So you got to go faster, David, because Alex is going to come out first.
It sounds like Goldust is a little different. So sort of my take on it was that, so what frustrated me about Trajan is you never actually got to use the Mancala pieces. They could just use your, or determine what action you did. So in Gold West, you... actually place resources into like a supply track, and then you use a Mancala type thing to move them forward, and whatever sort of spits out at the end are the resources you have to use this turn. And I implemented a trade-off where the farther back in your supply track you put the resources, the more points you got, but it would also take a lot longer for them to get to the front. And a lot of the ways to score points are sort of time sensitive. So that's the basic take on the game. But I think there's probably 1,000 ways you could do a take on a Mancala mechanic, and I think David's right that this is really a new, could be its own mechanic where you could...
I lost him. Is he still talking?
I think he's... I think we lost him.
Frozen in space.
Yeah, he died.
I have to admit, I've never played Mancala before. I'd only ever heard of it, and I just was doing some Wikipedia reading as you guys were talking, and I think I'm going to go out and find that game tomorrow so that I can try it.
Yeah, exactly.
It sounds kind of awesome.
It's fantastic, and it's an addictive little thing.
You can get the is it like the Front Porch Classics or whatever makes those little wooden like $10 games? That
even better because the they front, make I one. Love those the nice wooden boxes.
Yeah, they make one for like $10 or something. You can get a Mancala board. I have an actual like I love Mancala so much that I have a friend whose husband was in the Air Force and he was being stationed in Africa and they were like, "Do you want anything?" And I'm like, "Yes, I actually do." And so he went and got me like a hand carved, you know, tradition. Yeah. It's awesome. It's like my most prized possession.
I haven't found a Mancala board that I yet want to, you know, leave out on the coffee table, but I know there's one out there that will.
Oh, I own one. You would love it.
Yeah, no, exactly. That's the kind I've been looking for, and nobody has it. I don't want those stupid things that fold in the middle.
No, mine's got the traditional like tribal head carving on the top.
Oh, it's awesome.
It's amazing.
That's great stuff.
That's awesome.
And it was like $20 or something, you know what I mean? Like it's you know, somebody gave up their prized possession for $20 in Africa.
Right.
But yeah, I don't know if David, do you have anything that you're working on, or Jason or Chevy?
Well, like I said, I'm working on that game. And, I actually hoping to pitch it to a couple publishers at BGGCon. Dice Hate Me is actually coincidentally atop the list right now for that game for me. I always have a publisher in mind once I get to a certain stage in the game, and Dice Hate Me seems to be a good fit for where On Trip's going. And then I've got another micro that I'm messing around with. Micros are all the rage right now, right? plus, they're easy to do. After Ground Floor, which is just painstakingly getting playtesters for a two-hour, three-hour game is just a pain in the rear. Since then, I've had a hard time getting the motivation to jump back into a Deep Euro. Just harder in every way. I got another what I'm calling a 45-minute Euro, in the same vein as like Mikarinos, Yisbahan, Spikerstad, that sort of thing. And that's going to be called Clone Lab, and interesting, another take on worker placement. Of course, TC, you'll be sad.
Not sad. No, I'm just saying that's the question that you have to ask. Do you want to reinvent the wheel, or do you want to do something that other people have done? And the thing is, me trying to reinvent the wheel is usually a bad thing. I think these experiments are not as happy for people as I feel they are. But people like something that they can fall back on. It seems to be. It takes a while to be on the bleeding edge of things for people to actually pick up on that. It'll take a few years, but you hope, maybe.
Well, I mean, let me ask you this. Name a game that's completely unique in your book.
A game that's completely unique? Well, I find that mostly, if you're going to find a completely unique game, it's going to be a toy. As far as game designs that I thought were completely unique, I haven't hit one yet. Okay. I mean, basically, what I'm mainly saying is how far removed is your game from what's current out there? It's really tough to do something crazy.
Right. Well, I mean, the first thing that pops in my mind is Hanabi. There's nothing like it. It didn't borrow anything, unless you call. You know, putting numbered cards in a sequence, borrowing a mechanism.
You could call it a reverse co-op. Like, I know, instead of I take the co-op element and I go, oh, flip, now you don't know what you have, and the co-op is everything else. While it's a different thing, like I agree. I think it's like crazy innovative, especially because not only is it innovative, it's completely simple. Which is definitely crazy. That's like Dominion style. It's a very simple idea. You're just building your doing the thing that was fun about Magic the Gathering.
Right.
Why don't you just do that all the time? So I agree. It's very innovative, but I think it's definitely a twist, maybe.
The first game that came to my mind was String Railway. Is sure, it's sort of a route-building game, but the way it took the spatial element and made it almost completely free-form felt really unconventional to me. So
yeah, you guys are fast on picking up on these ones. These are good examples.
Beyond that, it's really hard to think of a game that's has all completely new elements, because it would be weird. It's sort of like trying to think of a color that doesn't exist. You just
and that answer
mental faculties to do it.
That comes back to answer TC's question. I mean, if we can't, in all of our experience and portfolio of games that we've played, if we can't right now name off unique games, then why would we waste our time trying to find our own unique design? If we can't even name off two games that are unique right now, why would I try to be one of those games that someone would think completely is unique?
Yeah, I I'd have to agree. I just think, but that's where the whole like idea of like game design comes from, I guess. It's you think your own thing is unique, I guess, is where I'm at right now. It's just like I keep thinking, oh man, my idea is unique, but then
it's at our definition of words, because when you keep saying unique, I mean, I think of something that has no characteristics that can be drawn on previously. But if you instead use a phrase like your game hasn't been done before, to me that opens up the door a little bit wider, because you can use previous mechanisms but they've never been done before in the way that you're mixing them.
Yeah, and I think that's fair to say, like, a game is considered unique-ish, not unique, but kind of unique, if you can at least take something that's out there and make it something different. You know, I mean, to use mechanics that already exist and then use them in a completely different way, I think is good enough to be unique.
I agree.
And I think that's what, as designers, we all strive for, right? Because you don't want to just make someone else's game over again.
No.
But you also, I think, you know, as designers, to try and come up with the true unique, like, no one has done this mechanic before, what's so hard about that is, as designers, we've all played a lot of games.
Right.
And so we're going to draw on what we enjoy, right? Like, if you know you like worker placement, you are going to try and design games that you would enjoy, just like if you like deck building or whatever.
Yeah.
I think if we could find someone who's never played a game ever and then ask them to design a game, they might be able to give us something unique.
Well, a lot of it is just like how we translate it internally. When I designed Scallywags, the coin mechanic in Scallywags is completely unique. Nobody's ever even, I mean, it's just completely unique. And it was so unique that I was like, I designed this coin mechanic, and then I thought, well now what do I do with these coins now that I've dumped them all on the table? How do I distribute them amongst the players? And I had to just fall back on, you know, a deck of cards, and we're going to play cards to pass coins around. So, yeah, I came up with this unique mechanic, but what do you do with it once you've got that little, you know, that's just 1/10 of the game. That's not even, you can't even play the game with just the coins. You know, or going back to my print and play that I just released, Pool, somebody, you know, that was just came from somebody on Twitter who was like, make me a game about shooting clay pigeons and make it trick-taking. And I thought, oh, okay, I've never done a trick-taking game, so how can I do that unique? Well, you know, when you shoot clay pigeons, a lot of times they shoot off two at the same time. I've never played a trick-taking game where there's two tricks going on at the same time. Okay, so now suddenly I have this unique little trick-taking mechanic. So to me, like, if that's what you're going for, TC, like, I get it, because that's the stuff that excites me to work on it, is having that little thing that you're like, oh, this part's really cool because this is my part. This is the part of the game about me, you know. And at the core of it, Pool is a trick-taking game. You've got hands of cards that have numbers on them, and you're trying to play them in the most efficient manner to score your team the most points. But I've got this cool little twist on it that's mine. Nobody else came up with it. It's me. And that's the part that gets me excited. If somebody came to me and said, Chevy, I want you to design a Dominion clone, I would just be like, no, no thank you. That sounds really boring to me because I can't, if I can't put me into it, then what's the point? It doesn't excite me, you know?
Yeah, and I think we have some Twitter comments on this, and I think the most recent one is the one that I think kind of sums up my issues at the moment is Flying Sheep says, unique mechanic is like my culinary experiments with baking radishes. Turns out there's a reason no one bakes radishes.
Exactly.
So I am playing a little bit of devil's advocate. I'm not crazy. I'm not saying, oh, everything's got to be unique or else you're a crazy designer and should get out. What I mean is, like Chevy and what everybody's kind of saying is you want to put your own unique twist on these things. And I think the hardest part for me is just getting over the fact that I am taking things from other people and I want everything to be, wow, I've never seen that. And you really just can't do it. And someone was saying as well, Flash Forward Game says, I used to be in the school of playing less games. Would get me thinking about something original, but I like playing more games now. And I think that's true, too. I mean, you can't just not play games because you want to turn a blind eye to the fact that you'll come up with something original. But usually, like we already had here, no one knows. We have two designers working on Mancala Mechanic. It's not bad. It's a good thing. And I think there's probably 10 more out there that are working on the same Mancala Mechanic. And that's fine. It's okay.
It's just gonna hurt
your heart.
And it's really TC, you're right. I mean, I know when I first started designing, and I talked about this on our show even, I felt like I was always stealing everything, right? Because you're like, well, but this game has this mechanic, or you know, there was a mechanic I really liked in a game called Lawless that was this sliding purchasing scale mechanic, and I just loved it so much, and it made me want to design games, and that was so awesome. And I thought it was so unique, and then I played Stone Age, and it's the exact same mechanic that's in Stone Age with how you purchase things, and they slide down the line in cost. And because when I wanted to use that in one of my games, and I thought, oh, I'm just stealing from this game to do this, you know. But no, I mean, it's just a mechanic that people use sometimes. I think, you know, it reminds me of what they say in the movie industry when it comes to, like, making a sequel to a movie. They say, give me the same thing, only different. And that's what people want with games. I don't know that people want truly unique games as a rule. And the reason I say that is because there's something about when you go to play a game, when I go to play another deck-building game, and I think, oh, this feels familiar, right? You know, Rob Couch, one of the other people on this show quite a bit, has a game called Frankenstein's Legacy, and it's a deck-building game. And the first time I played it, and my friends and I, we all play-tested it for him, it was great because even though it's nothing like Dominion, it's a deck-building game. So when he was explaining the rules, he's like, and then this is kind of like a standard deck builder with this, this, and this. And it's amazing how quickly everybody picks up on that, right? And they do that because it's familiar. So there are a lot of huge bonuses to something being familiar rather than being completely unique to where, you know, it's completely alien to you. That makes the game harder to learn. And also, I think that can make the barrier for entry higher, which is not always a good thing, right? I mean, if you're
dealing with... set expectations. That's the problem that you have to avoid. Is like if I come to you and I say, why don't you play my deck building game, then you immediately have expectations about what this game is going to be. And that can be difficult to overcome.
But something else to remember that can be good about that is if you say, come try my deck building game, and I think, I hate deck building games, right? Then I can say, hey, I'm not going to be good at, you know, I had a prototype I was working on for a while that Rob tried for me, and it was like a strategy war game type game, and Rob came into it saying, you know, I don't like these kind of games, so my feedback is going to be skewed based on that. And he still was able to give good feedback, but that was always something to remember, you know, was, so I think that can be helpful. We're also running short on time here, so just going to throw out this 7-minute warning as it is. I think we want to make sure that we let our guests go through and maybe give some good advice and such before they go, like the best wisdom they have, like the best. I just want the viewers to know that before the show started, we asked them what their best advice was, and it was the most amazing, unique advice I'd ever heard. And now they're going to impart it to you. Your minds are about to be blown, so just be ready for that. Alex, you were really excited to talk about it. So what were you going to say?
Sure, yeah. I had a great conversation about this before the show. No, but I mean, if you're a game designer, it has to be you. So you have to figure out what kind of games you like and why you like them. Whether it's the trade-offs that are implicit in those games, or maybe a game gave you sort of a great sense of satisfaction, figure out what it was in the game that made you feel that way, and sort of figuring out how to play games and see the things that are making you feel the things that you feel, or strategize the way that you strategize, and think about how you can start to infuse
Oh, Alex, I think we're losing you again.
With incentive structures, or building things around a trade-off and being able to find. So I'll just finish up. So when I say, we always lose me when I talk. I don't know what that is. So when I say finding the game within your game, TC is cracking up. But the game meaning what sort of incentive structure am I playing here? What's driving my decisions, and what are the trade-offs that I'm making in my game? So being able to play games critically and infuse sort of what you've learned into your own games to make sure that they're sort of solid games is important. So I don't know how much of that came through, but that's my advice.
Excellent. No, most of that came through.
And okay, good. You
sounded really smart, too, so good work. That was great.
Almost exactly the way you said it before the show, Alex.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, precisely. Word for word.
But, hey, so, yeah, let's how about David now? What you got for advice for game designers?
Well, I'm going to switch it up from what we talked about before the show, and I'm going to throw you guys for a curve. When somebody tells me about their idea and they want advice, and it's in the early stages, the first thing I always say is start your game design at the end. Know how you want it to finish. Know what you want the people to feel like when they're finished. Do you want them high-fiving each other? Do you want them laughing? Do you want them tearing their hair out because they didn't have enough actions? What is your end game condition? Those are the things that you need to figure out before you go back to the beginning and actually start laying stuff out. If you don't have the end, you don't know what you're driving towards. And so that's the first thing, first piece of advice I always give everybody that pitches me a game or tells me about, oh, well, I've got this idea, but not really sure how I want to take this first few steps, and you know, I'm not sure what this should cost. Well, I'm like, well, what's the end game trigger? How does the game end? Oh, I don't know. I'm not sure how that's going to work. You definitely need to know where you're going, how the game ends, and what you want people to come away with when the game's over. So that's my advice.
I think excellent.
That's good advice. That's very good advice.
Cool. Well, so we're almost out of time here. I just want to take a couple minutes to thank you guys for being part of the show this week, David and Alex, and of course TC and Chevy, as you're always here with us, just like I am. So yeah, that's exciting. But no, special thanks to David and Alex, because you guys are great. You had some good advice and some good thoughts. And
sure, thanks for having us.
Yeah, definitely. No, it's great. Good times. All right, and thank you to everybody for all those questions that we got. We actually got some good questions this week, and that was great. It's always fun to be able to answer the questions as we go. As always, this will be posted on the BTG Club site a little later this week. You'll be able to view it on YouTube forever, ever, ever, ever. Yeah, so we'll be back again in 2 weeks. Some of us will be here, along with a couple of special guests that TC is lining up, like he always does such a great job at. So.
Gatekeeper.
Yeah. I'm not making fun. I mean, we keep getting awesome guests on the show.
Best gatekeeper.
Fantastic guests. So, yeah.
The best DC guest. The gatekeeper. So, all right. Well, thank you to all the listeners out there, and good night.